before we begin, we're hosting a Tisch this Friday night. I have these little flyers. If anyone wants to take home a flyer as a visual reminder, they're here. I'll put them right here.
With the food.
Right next to the food.
Is there so now you have to. Charcuterie board?
Yeah, exactly. Barbecue. Okay, so last time we spoke, we're speaking about the power of a moment. So last time we spoke about the power of inspiration. We spoke about Rav Moshe Shapiro and how he was inspired by his mother to start Daf Yomi, by her energy, by her words, and how he used that as his inspiration for everything. And I started off with the question, who do you think had the biggest impact on modern-day Torah Judaism? So I promise I'm not going to do it every single time, but I want to start off with a similar question. And that would be, which book, which sefer do you think has had the biggest impact on modern-day Torah Judaism? And this one, last time I spoke about names that I thought about, maybe this person, maybe that person, this one was not a question. I had one book came to mind, and it was the only book that I think has had the biggest impact on modern-day Torah Judaism. So if I were to open up the question to you, what would you say? The Gemara. That's fine. So I'll tell you what I would say. I would say that there was a book put out in the late 1900s called Shmira Shabbos Kehilchosa. Right. It was written by someone named Rabbi Yehoshua Neubert, or Neuwirth. It depends on, in Hebrew it's spelled Neubert. In English, people like to call it Neuwirth. I'm going to call him Rav Neubert, which I cannot pronounce, but I'm going to call him anyway, because that's the way he's always been referred to me. And so he actually has the most fascinating story. So before we get into why he wrote his book and why it made such an impact, I just want to tell his story. If you're going to guess, like, oh, what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next, I promise you whatever your guess is going to be, change it to the opposite, and that's what's going to happen next. So he was born 1927 in Berlin, in Germany. He's the son of a rabbi, the son of a congregational rabbi. His father had been a rabbi at a bunch of places in Europe, and as you can guess as the story goes, so 1938 comes around, the Nazis come into power, they came into power before that, Kristallnacht happens, and his father was actually smart enough to see, Kristallnacht, I'm going to get my son out of here. So he took his three sons, there were four kids, three sons, one daughter. They took the three sons, and they put them on a kinder transport. And the kinder transports, they were a great thing. They were also had a lot of difficulties to them, because a lot of kids went on to kinder transports, and they were never seen again. They were converted out of Judaism, thousands of kids. He was lucky enough that he was put on a kinder transport to Belgium, to his family. So he and his two brothers go to his family in Belgium, and they spend the next year and a half there. And then after year and a half, his father is actually able to get out of Germany. What happened? The King of Holland said, we will take 42 rabbis. 42 rabbis. That's it. We'll take 42 rabbis from all of Germany. Them, their wives, their families, they can come. That's it. So his father was one of those 42. And they went to Amsterdam. They went to Holland in 1939. And they were able somehow, the father, the mother, the daughter went, and they were able somehow to get these three boys from Belgium to Amsterdam. And they're all reunited in Amsterdam, which at the time was not under Nazi rule, right? So it wasn't the best way of life, but they were together. And then in 1940, a year later, the Nazis come in. And life goes back to being awful. And you would think life goes back to being, you would think that like, it's so decrepit and they're going to be in this small space and bunched in with a lot of people. Like I said, everything you're going to guess, it's the opposite. For some reason, his father was chosen by the Jewish underground to be their rabbi. They wanted a leader. It's actually an incredible thing. In Poland, they had a rabbi in Poland. They used to go ask questions to the rabbi in Poland. How do we know that they went to ask questions to the rabbi in Poland? He wrote them down. He put them into those milk jugs and he buried them. And years later, someone was digging and they found them. And it's books. You can find books of the questions that they were asking their rabbi in Poland and the answers. So in Holland, they wanted something similar. So they appointed Rabbi Neubert. He's going to be the rabbi of Holland, the rabbi of Amsterdam. And they were supporting him through this. And they supported him in two ways. One was he used to get food delivered to his door. He'd open the door and there'd be food sitting there. An amazing thing. Not a lot of food. They weren't wealthy people, but he had food sitting there. And the other thing is they forged a rations card. And so he talks about how his sister was this tall, blonde-haired girl. She fit in, so she would walk out. She didn't look Jewish. She would stand in the rations line. They thought that she was also Netherlandian, a Hollander, an Amsterdammer, and they would give her the Dutch. Thank you. I'm glad you could think of that. And they would give her the food with this forged card. I mean, this was a huge risk. A Jewish girl with a forged card. She was gone. If they got caught, she was gone, and the family was gone. She never got caught. For 3 years, she never got caught. 1943 comes around. In 1943, they liquidated Amsterdam. The Nazis took out all the Jews. And so we can imagine it. They're sitting in their house, suitcases packed, jackets on, waiting for the knock. Right? The Nazis are starting on one end of Amsterdam, and they're making their way through, knocking on doors, waiting for a response. You don't get a response, and you go right in. The craziest thing happens. The Nazis come to the courtyard of where their apartment was. And they yell out, "Are there any Jews here?" And the neighbor who they're afraid of, the neighbor who they're saying, if someone's going to report a Jew, it's going to be this guy, goes up to the Nazis and he says, "I don't know of any Jews here. I don't know of any Jews here." And they left. And the Gemara actually talks about that if a miracle happens to you, you can make that day into a Purim. You can make that day into a holiday for you. So the whole Neubert family, they have a Purim on that day. Whatever day that was, he doesn't actually specify in his introduction, but they have a Purim on that day where they celebrate. They have a whole meal. They have a whole celebration for that day. Because it's the craziest thing. The Nazis assumed that there were no Jews there. And so for the rest of the war, for the next 2 years, they lived in their apartment. They lived at home. They didn't go near any doors. They didn't go near any windows. But they lived at home. And then Amsterdam gets liberated. And if you think that's the end of the story, well, the story's just starting. So then Amsterdam gets liberated. And Rav Yehoshua Neubert, the son, so he's decided he's going to make Aliyah. He's going to go what's then known as Palestine. He's going to do it illegally. And so what he does is I don't know how they work this out. They got American soldier uniforms. And they were crossing borders. And they got all the way to France. So they're in France. I mean, that's not so many borders. But it's two borders. So they're in France. And they're being told, okay, your ship's coming. It's going to take you to Palestine. It's going to take you to Israel. It's leaving on Shabbos. Mm-hmm. So I left out a very important detail. And that is, for those 2 years that they were stuck and they couldn't go near any doors and near any windows, he had two books with him. The son of a rabbi, he had two books with him. A Gemara Ksubis, which talks about if you're marrying a woman, the ksuba that you write, the marital contract that you make. And of the Mishnah Berurah, there's six volumes of Mishnah Berurah. They had the third volume, Chelek Gimel. Chelek Gimel is the laws of Shabbos. Right? Mishnah Berurah talks all about your daily life, from waking up to all the way through holidays. Chelek Gimel talks about Shabbos. So he had two books. So for 2 years, he couldn't go outside. He couldn't go to the window. They couldn't be loud. They couldn't do anything. He sat and he studied. And those were the two books that he studied for those 2 years. On top of that, they were in hiding, but he had somehow memorized the Luach. He had memorized the Jewish calendar. So he knew, without a calendar, he's a genius, obviously. He knew the days of the week. He knew everything. And he knew when Shabbos was. They kept Shabbos. They kept Yontiv. They were as firm as they come. And so now he has to get on a boat on Shabbos, and he agonizes over it. He talks about how it was one of the hardest decisions he had to make, and he thought, maybe I should just stay here. Maybe I should not get on this boat. I can just desecrate Shabbos. I've kept Shabbos for years in the worst of times. Maybe I should just stay right where I am. And then he came to his senses, and he decided, I have no food. I have no money. I don't speak the language. I have nowhere to go. I'm just going to not get on the boat. I'm going to strand myself in the middle of France. So he decides he's getting on the boat. But as he decides he's getting on the boat, he makes a promise to himself. So that was all really a 6-page introduction boiled down into 10 minutes. But I took the last paragraph of that 6-page introduction, and it's the first source. And he says, Kasher na'alatzi la'alos ha'aniya, when I obligated myself to go onto the boat, listabech b'chil Shabbos, and to engage in breaking Shabbos, kibalti al'atmi, I accepted upon myself, shekarsh baruch hu yizkei osi, if a karsh baruch hu will help me get there, he'll merit to help me get there, v'asem mashu avor Shabbos, and I'll do a little something for Shabbos, v'kach Allah harayon liktov sefer al shmir Shabbos. And so that's when I had the idea, I'm going to write a book all about keeping Shabbos. And he says, Achrei huledes b'ni b'chori, after my first son was born, samti lev she'ein sefer ha'osef b'socho es hilchol Shabbos, b'safa ha'shabbat kol nefesh. He said, once my first son was born, I decided there was no book out there that had all the laws of Shabbos that was written in a way that was easy to understand. V'chdei la'anos al she'ilos harabos ha'misaros b'kol Shabbos, that would answer all the questions that come up every single Shabbos. He says, v'az, at that time, hischalti b'ksivaso al sefer. That is when I started to write this book. When he started to write Shmir Shabbos. Shmir Shabbos is an incredible book. It's been incredibly successful. They're up to the third version of it. And third version is where it's going to stay, because in 2013, Rav Neubert was nifter. But he had three versions of it. And every time he went back to it, and he edited it, and he added stuff to it, and he took stuff out to it. And people talk about that. In the first version, he said this, and now he says that. But I think what the most incredible thing about this book is not that he wrote the book, not that he decided to write the book. I always talk about how people become experts in nothing just so they can write a book. They become experts in like the most obscure topic because they want to write a book. And if anyone's at Shal Shudas this past week, so Rav Stuhlberger talked about a very famous story of the Netziv. The Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, he was not the best of students, and he heard his parents talking about how maybe we should take him out of school. It's a lot of money. Maybe we should teach him a trade. And they said, maybe let's make him into a shoemaker. And he went to his parents and he begged, please don't make me a shoemaker. And when he wrote his first book, it was really a series of books, and he was celebrating it, and he told this story about how he heard his parents, and he accepted upon himself he was going to be a better student. And he talks about what it would be like after 120 years. And he'd be standing in front of a Kaddish Baruch Hu, and a Kaddish Baruch Hu would put this book in front of him. He'd say, you could have written this. Why didn't you write this? And so they say about some other people that they'll put the book that they wrote in front of them, and they'll say, you could have made me a really nice pair of shoes. Where is my really nice pair of shoes? So for Rav Neubert, it's definitely not the case. He wrote exactly what he was supposed to do. And I think the most incredible thing about it was he looked at what do the Jewish people need. What do they not have? What's going to help them out? And so he said, you know what's going to help them out? If I can write a book in an easy-to-understand way. And people have taken this idea and they've run with it. You know, some have made books that are going to change the course of history, and some have made books that they'd be better off being shoemakers. But they've run with it either way. And you can find all over the place. You can find these books on every single topic, written in an easy-to-understand way, great footnotes. It compiles everything in Hebrew, in English, and he was the first of his kind. And I think that's the most incredible thing about this whole story. So when I was thinking about the power of what, I was thinking about, there are many powers here. There's the power of a promise, there's the power of Shabbos, there's the power of mitzvos, but I wanted to talk about the power of innovation. Which I think a lot of people, I mean, obviously I want to talk about the power of innovation. I wrote it on the top of the page. But I think a lot of people, when they hear the power of innovation, they think, what are you talking about? Orthodox Jews? Innovation? We don't innovate. Orthodox is like the opposite of innovation. Orthodox means to keep status quo. So I'm hopefully going to show you that we definitely do innovate. Rav Neubert was not the first person in Jewish history to look at the Jewish people and say, what book can I write to help these people? So the Rambam actually did something similar to this. The Rambam took the Gemara, which the Gemara is supposed to be a halacha book. It's very hard to understand. If you ask a high schooler, why do you not like learning Gemara? They say it's so unclear. Well, I can't get anything out of this. Which is true. It's so unclear. You can't get anything out of it. So the Rambam decided, I'm going to make it very clear. I'm going to say we do this, and we do that, and we do this, and we do that. He was the first Shulchan Aruch. The problem with the Rambam, though, is he didn't quote his sources. You always got to quote your sources, right? Or else you get, or else your teacher accuses you of plagiarism, and you don't want that. So he's got to quote your sources. But he wrote in his introduction, and a lot of people question his introduction for this reason. He wrote in his introduction how Torah was passed down, starting from Moshe Rabbeinu and Har Sinai, all the way down to him. He quoted names he had from this generation, that generation, this generation, that generation, and he tells about how Torah went from the oral Torah to the oral Torah that was written down. From being totally oral to being the Gemara, to being the Mishnah. So I put the introduction of the Rambam here in source number 2. And he talks about Rabbeinu HaKadosh Chiver HaMishnah. So he talks about Rabbeinu HaKadosh, which is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, which we call him Rabbeinu our Rebbe, our Rabbi. And he says that he was the one who wrote down the Mishnah. Umiyamos Moshe V'ad Rabbeinu HaKadosh, from Moshe Rabbeinu until Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Lo Chibru Chibur. Nobody had written it down. Why? Nobody had written down what? Shemalam din oso berabim b'torah shabal peh. Nobody had written it down because they used to teach it orally in like a big classroom. El shabakol dor v'dor rosh basin o nevi shiyah b'oso ador. Every single generation, whoever the leader of the generation was, they would kosev la'atmo zikaron b'shmos shishama mirabosav v'hu melamed al peh berabim. So whoever the leader of the generation was would write down like notes for themselves, basically, about what they had heard, what they had learned, and then they would go and they would teach that to people. And so I'll skip the second paragraph. In the second paragraph, he says that they would teach that to people, and everyone would scribble down for themselves. And everyone scribbled down their own notes, and that's how we didn't have bookshelves and bookshelves. People just kind of had their own writing, and that's what they did and that's how it was passed on from one generation to another. V'hu kibetz kola, in the third paragraph, he says, V'hu, meaning Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, kibetz kola shmuos, he wrote down every single teaching, v'kola din, every single halacha, v'kola be'irin, v'ha perushin, and every single explanation, shishama m'moshe Rabbeinu, that Moshe Rabbeinu himself taught, v'shalimdu basin shalachol dor v'dor, and that every single rabbi who had led every single generation at that, v'chol ha-Torah kula. He wrote down everything. V'chiber m'kol sefer ha-Mishnah. And he wrote it down into the what we call the Mishnah. V'shaninu v'rabim, and he taught it to everyone, v'nigla l'chol Yisrael. And it was revealed to everyone. V'kasavu kulam, and everyone wrote down what he had said, word for word. V'ripsi b'kol makom, and they spread it out to every single place. K'dei shalo tishtachach, Torah Shabbal Pam Yisrael. So that the Torah, that the oral Torah, would not be lost from the Jewish people. So maybe you're thinking to yourself, well, what's so bad about that? It was an oral Torah, it was the oral tradition, and he wrote it down. And so therefore it wouldn't be lost. It sounds like a really good thing. In theory, it is a really good thing. But we have a Gemara here in Gittin that says, Darash Rabbi Yehuda Bar Nachmani, Mesor Gemane de Rabbi Shimon Ben Lakish. So Rabbi Yehuda Bar Nachmani, who was basically the loudspeaker for Rabbi Shimon Ben Lakish. What they used to do is the rabbi used to kind of speak in a soft tone, and then somebody else would say it really loudly for him. So that's what this guy's job was. Kasiv, the Torah says, Kasov l'cha es ha'devarim ha'ela. You should write down these words. Ukasiv, and the same pasuk says, Ki al pi ha'devarim ha'ela. Because according to these words, al pi means that orally. So one part, in the first part of the pasuk, it says you should write them down. Second part of the pasuk, it says you should transmit it orally. So the Gemara asks, Haketad, how can you have something that's both written down and orally transmitted? The Gemara says, Devarim shebiksav, iyata roshay la'omran al peh. Something that is written down, you're not allowed to recite it from memory. Devarim shebal peh, iyata roshay la'omran shebiksav. And something that is oral, you're not allowed to write down. Right? So the rule was, you could not write the Mishnah down. We were not allowed to write the Mishnah down. So why was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, why did he decide that he was going to break the rules? Because he saw that the generations were getting weaker. He saw that the Talmidim, the students, they weren't as smart. He saw that the hardship was getting harder. He saw that the kingships, they were inflicting us more and more. And he thought that if we kept it oral, we're going to lose it. Right? He saw the writing on the wall. Because it takes a long time. For example, if you were to learn one Mishnah a day, it would take you 14 years to cover all the Mishnahs from beginning to end. Everything that Rabbi Yehuda and Nasi had written down. So it takes a long time for one person to memorize this, however smart you are. Because you have to review, and then you have to add on, and you have to review, and you have to add on, and you have to constantly make sure. And so he decided if we kept it this way, and the Jews are getting spread out, and there are all these people who are coming around, they're saying, you can't learn your own Torah, we're going to lose it. And he relied on a pasuk in Tehillim here in source number 5, which says, Eis la'asos la'Hashem hefiru sarasecha. That there is a time, if you're doing it for a Kadosh Baruch Hu, you can annul your Torah. Like we say in English, some rules are meant to be broken. So it's not a perfect parallel, but I think what Rav Neubert did by looking at the generation and saying, what do these people need? I'm going to write something that's going to help them stay religious, help them stay connected to the Torah. It's very similar to what Rav Yehuda Nasi did. I mean, Rav Yehuda Nasi was a rule breaker, and Rav Neubert was just doing it in a different way. But they were looking and they were saying, they need something. What can I write? How can I help them? How can I help them? And I want to give another parallel from old and new, a different innovation, and that is Sarah Schnierer, or Schnierer. Yeah. In her biography, she's Schnierer. So I never know which one to go with. Schnierer?
Yeah, I think so.
Schnierer. So Sarah Schnierer, she's known as the one who started the Beis Yaakov schooling. She started Beis Yaakov in 1917 in Krakow, in Poland. And basically, long story short, she really wanted to start it sooner. She tried to start it in 1903. They brought it up at the Aguda Convention in 1903, and it got shot down. They said, no good. It's too innovative for us. They weren't okay with the idea. But really, if it weren't for her, the Torah would have been lost. Jewish women would have been lost. She was seeing how Jewish women were just going away from Torah. There was no influence for them. There was no learning for them. There was no Wednesday night shir with cookies and fruit for them. They were being totally, totally lost. And she said, something has to happen. And she fought. She fought and she fought and she fought. For 14 years, she fought to get this school started. And she got the Gedolei Torah on her side. She got the Chafetz Chaim on her side. And finally, in 1917, she was allowed to start this school. This school, which now I think has something like 35,000 students in it internationally. You'll find a Beis Yaakov everywhere. And Baruch Hashem that she fought because she saved Judaism. But she has also a parallel to her in the Gemara. If you look here in source number 6, it's an even a closer parallel. So the Gemara in Bava Basra talks about the Amar of Yehuda, Amar of Baram. So Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rav Baram, Zachor Osa Ish Latov. We should remember this one person for good. V'Yoshua ben Gamla Shimon. Who is that person? Rabbi Yoshua ben Gamla. She'il Malehu. Without him, Nishtakach Torah Mi'Yisrael. The entire Torah would have been forgotten. Why? Shebetzechila Mishi Yishlo Ab Melamdo Torah. Mishi Ein Lolav Lo Hayalamed Torah. So he said, originally, what was it? If you had a father, the father taught their sons Torah. And a boy who didn't have a father, nobody taught him Torah. My darsh, and they learned out from the pasuk of Limimadatem Osam, that you should teach them to them. And he learned out Limimadatem Atem, that you should teach them, meaning fathers should teach their sons. So he decided, okay, it's not so the Jewish people decided it's not going to work. Hiskinu shiyu moshivin melamdi tinokos v'yushalayim. So they said, okay, we're going to have one school. We'll have one school in Yerushalayim. Bring your kid up to Yerushalayim, and they'll go to school there. Ma'idarash ki mitzion teitzei Torah. And so where do they learn that from? Because the pasuk says that from Tzion, here from Yerushalayim, that's where Torah comes out from. Va'adayin mish yeshlo av. Still, the person who had a father, hayam alo milando. So he was taken there, and he would learn in the school. Mish ein lo av lo hay ola velamed. And someone who didn't have a father had no one to bring them to this school. And so therefore they had nothing, they weren't able to go. So the Jewish people decided, okay, we'll try something new. Hiskinu shiyu moshivin b'kol pelach u'felach u'machnisin osa kivin sheish esrei u'kivin sheva esrei. So they made schools in every single county, let's say. San Diego County would have had a school. And when you're 16 or 17 years old, so you'll go to the school in San Diego County. Well, there's a big problem with that. Not that it's San Diego County, but it's Misha Hayarabo Koisalab Mevaibo Viotse. If you're 16 or 17 and your teacher makes you angry, what are you going to do? You're going to kick him and walk out. Those are the actual words. Mevaibo Viotse. You're going to kick him and walk out. I'm not going to stand for this. I'm just going to kick him and walk out. So they said that doesn't work either. Ad Shabo Yoshua Ben Gamla. Until Yoshua Ben Gamla came around. And what did he do? V'sigen Shio Moshivin Melande Tinokas B'kol Medina Medina B'kol Ir Ir. Every single city needs to have its own school. U'mach Nisan Osan Kevin Sheish Kevin Sheva. And so people were to bring their kids there when their kids were 6 or 7 years old. If that sounds very familiar to you, it's because that's very much similar to the school system now, everywhere. And not just the yeshiva school system, but the public school system too. You, at 6 or 7 years old, kids start to go to school. And so, what did Rabbi Yoshua Ben Gamla see? He saw that people weren't learning Torah. And if you don't learn Torah, you're not going to have people who are dedicated to Torah, who are loving Torah. You don't have role models. And so he decided we're going to start schools. Not in one place, but in every single city. Every single city needs to have its own school. We need to do something about this. Sarah Schneer saw the same thing. She saw it wasn't the boys this time, it was the girls. She said, okay, great, the boys are taken care of. The girls need something. And if we don't do something for the girls, we're going to have nothing. We're going to lose everything. And so she fought for it. And just like Yoshua Ben Gamla in the Gemara, she fought for it and she established it and she saved Judaism as we know it. So the last piece I want to talk about is a piece by the Rav, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. And so in this piece, he's talking about Masora, what we typically call tradition. So I said at the beginning that most people's gut reaction is innovation, Jews, it can't happen. Right? We're Orthodox. We kind of keep the status quo. Masora is that word for Orthodox. It's for tradition. It's the word we typically use for it. But I think this is a fascinating piece, and the way he talks about it will kind of help us wrap everything back together. So just to give a little context for this piece, the Rav is talking about giving class. He's talking about himself sitting in front of a room full of students. And the way the Rav used to give class, it was basically, he used to sit there with a desk, and the students would all pile around the desk. They were all kind of like sitting on top of him. And he used to have a roster, and he would go down the roster, and you would have to read the Gemara. And he would grill you as you read the Gemara. He would ask you a bunch of questions. And at the end, once he was done the roster, so then he would start calling on people at random. And so he went, there was a story that he went through the roster one day and he chose a name at random and the guy hadn't prepared. He wasn't ready, right? You typically know it's your day if you're next on the list. So the guy wasn't ready to read this Gemara for everyone in front of the Rav. And so he read this name and the guy whose name it was, he said, oh, he's not here today. So the Rav said, okay, fine. So then you read. And the guy who tried to get out of it had to read anyway. So here, source number 7, he talks about, it's the personal account from the Rav on Masora, on tradition. So he says, the old Rebbe walks into the classroom crowded with students who are young enough to be his grandchildren, which he's literally talking about himself. He enters as an old man with wrinkled face, his eyes reflecting the fatigue and sadness of old age. You have to be old to experience the sadness, as the melancholy that results from an awareness of people and things which have disappeared and linger only in memory. I sit down. Opposite me are rows of young, beaming faces with clear eyes radiating the joy of being young. For a moment, the Rebbe is gripped with pessimism. With tremors of uncertainty, he asks himself, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher and young students? Between a Rebbe in his Indian summer, I'm not sure if that's politically correct, but it's what he wrote, okay? And students enjoying the spring of their lives? The Rebbe starts his shiur uncertain as to how it will proceed. Suddenly, the door opens and an old man, much older than the Rebbe, enters. Meaning, I should have added this. When he's talking about these older people, the people older than him, he's talking about books. These are the books that he's reading in front of him. But he's treating them as if they're people walking in the room. He's the grandfather of the Rebbe, Reb Chaim Brisker. It would be most difficult to study Talmud with students who are trained in the sciences and mathematics were it not for this method, which is very modern and equals, if not surpasses, most contemporary forms of logic, metaphysics, and philosophy. The door opens again, and another old man comes in. He is older than Reb Chaim, for he lived in the 17th century. His name is Reb Shabtai Cohen, known as the Shach. The Shach is a commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, who must be present when Dine Mamonot, civil law, is discussed. Many more visitors arrive, some from the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, and others harking back to antiquity, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, Rambam, Rabbid Rashba, Rebbe Akiva, and others. These scholarly giants of the past are bidden to take their seats. The Rebbe introduces the guests to his pupils, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam states a halacha. The Rabbid disagrees sharply, as is his wont. Some students interrupt to defend the Rambam, and they express themselves harshly against the Rabbid, as young people are apt to do. The Rebbe softly corrects the students and suggests more restrained tones. The Rashba smiles gently. The Rebbe tries to analyze what the students meant, and other students intercede. Rabbeinu Tam is called upon to express his opinion, and suddenly a symposium of generations comes into existence. Young students debate earlier generations with an air of daring familiarity, and a crescendo of discussion ensues. All speak one language, all pursue one goal, all are committed to a common vision, and all operate with the same categories. A Masorah collegiality is achieved, a friendship, a comradeship of old and young, spanning antiquity, the Middle Ages, and modern times. This joining of the generations, this march of centuries, this dialogue and conversation between antiquity and the present will finally bring about the redemption of the Jewish people. After a 2 or 3 hour shiur, the Rebbe emerges from the chamber young and rejuvenated. He has defeated age. The students look exhausted. In the Masorah experience, years play no role. Hands, however parchment dry and wrinkled, embrace warm and supple hands in commonality, bridging the gap which separates the generations. Thus, the old ones of the past continue their great dialogue of generations, ensuring an enduring commitment to the Masorah. The way he describes Masorah in this piece, tradition, it's not that we're continuing on doing that which we did. It's finding a way that new can mend with old. Finding a way that we can see how old is relevant to new, to put it in opposite terms. Right, finding a way to show how all this that we've been doing for years and years and years still applies, how it can still help us, how it applies to our technology, it applies to our lives, it applies to our relationships, it applies to everything. And I think that's the power of innovation. So we're not trying to recreate a new religion, it's that we're trying to show how it all works, how we can reinvigorate the generation. When Rav Yehuda Anasi saw that people were just, they were spreading out, we were going to lose it. So he innovated. He wrote everything down. Rav Neubert saw that people, they didn't have the time, they didn't have the headspace to learn Hilchos Shabbos, but they still wanted it. He innovated. He made something that he knew that people would be attached to and would help them grow. When Rav Yehoshua ben Gamla saw that people weren't learning Torah, he innovated. He made the schools that helped keep our Torah alive. And when Sarah Schneer saw that the same was happening to the girls, she innovated as well. And it's not that they were doing brand new things. It's really that they were looking to the past as a precedent to see how can we help the present generation. I think that is the power of innovation. It's about keeping the new generation excited about our sacred traditions. So thank you guys again for coming to learn with me. And I hope you found that insightful.